Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Millennials Are Killing Capitalism Live. Please take a minute, like the video, share it on social media, let people know that we're live and that we're having this conversation, whether you're on Twitter or Instagram or here with us on YouTube. The YouTube chat is the one that we'll use to respond to comments and questions if people have them. And so join us on YouTube if you want to engage in the conversation. Today we're going to talk about Sudan, which we haven't done a whole lot. We've done it as kind of part of a few different conversations over the years, but never really anything that's just dedicated solely to the topic and the discussion. And obviously there's a lot to talk about. So looking forward to this. Our guest, folks may have seen, has been on Adnan Hussein's show. Shout out to Adnan. Has been on Justin on the Anti-Empire show with Justin Potter, and also I think East is the podcast. And so yeah, so just excited to have him on. Hamza is his name. He's an organizer and writer whose work focuses on Pan-African and Palestinian solidarity. He coordinates humanitarian fundraising efforts, which is really how I came to get to know him a little bit, for communities who need it most, and produces political analysis rooted in anti-imperialist principles. He created a website with verified Sudanese campaigns, sudanfunds.com, which I'll pull up in a little bit, and I'm sure we will talk about today, and runs an aid network. I will let him pronounce it for me, that works both with community kitchens across Sudan and serves multiple refugee camps in Gaza with aid distributions. And links to that, both of those are in the show description. There's also a Telegram channel, Sudan News English, which is in the show description, where he and others work to provide on the ground updates of things going on in the genocide and the war in Sudan. So really grateful to have him. A couple, just like a housekeeping thing for our Patreon this month. We do have a promotion currently that is in the show description. So if you join at the $5 a month tier or the annual version of that, which I think is like $54, basically you get 50% off if you do yearly. So you could get a yearly subscription at that $5 a month level for $27. Or you can get 50% off your first month, and that's at all the tiers, $5 and above, if you want to support the show. And even if you just want to do the dollar a month or $10.80 per year subscription, it really helps us. And just with that, like, you do get bonus content, stuff like that, but most of what you get is access to our study groups, which we do, which are always like, you know, often 8 to, I think the current one we're in is like 14 weeks or something like that. And so the next one won't open up until February, but we'll do at least 3 next year. And say you do a yearly subscription, you have access to those all year long. So just encourage people to do that. It's a fun thing to do, honestly, like reading with a whole bunch of other people who are, you know, anti-imperialists, who are trying to figure out, their politics and sort through that together and understand, you know, these works, which sometimes can be kind of difficult, honestly, to read all by yourself, right? And so, invite people to join in that, and really looking forward to having this discussion today with Hamza. So I'm going to bring Hamza to the stage now. Hey, man, it's good to be with you.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me, Garrett.
Yeah, of course. We've been going back and forth on this for a while, and I'm glad we could finally kind of align our schedules to, have this discussion with folks. And so maybe just to start, like, why don't we just kind of do an introductory thing, and you can just share a little bit more about yourself and, you know, share a little bit about, some of the organizing work as well as like mutual aid or fundraising work that you're involved in related to Sudan.
Right. So right now, like you mentioned before, we have the Sudan Funds website, which is basically just campaigns are brought up to us that are on the ground in Sudan. We speak to the people involved, or we speak to the family that's in Sudan. We do the whole verification process through multiple channels, and then if they pass the verification process, we put them up on the website. And sorry, that gives people an option of who to donate to, basically. And then we're also the one that you mentioned after that, which is the aid network, the Abu Huraira aid network. Sorry, I'm sorry. Let me just clear my throat real quick. Okay. So the Abu Huraira aid network basically works. We're partnered with community kitchens across Sudan. From Omdurman, we were working with community kitchens in Fasher up until it fell. We're working in around different areas in Darfur, as well as Khartoum State, El Gazira State, a couple of other state, Kordofan, in Sudan. And basically, because those community kitchens already exist, they serve different neighborhoods in Sudan, and we help raise funds and send it over there, and they use that to help people. You know, some people, that's their only source of food right now. And then in Gaza, we have teams in different refugee camps that are under the Abu Huraira aid network, who basically just distribute different aid packages to families, especially families who can't really come to like distribution points, like orphans, disabled people, the elderly, that kind of thing. We come right to their tent, and sometimes it's ingredients that they can cook with for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, that kind of thing. Sometimes it's food that's ready. Last week we actually did meat, which we haven't been able to do for I'm sure you know, for a very long time in Gaza. So yeah, so that's what we do for the Abu Huraira aid network. And then the last thing I'd like to bring up for right now is just we have a boycott basically against the UAE, which we'll talk about later, and anybody basically who's backing the RSF, which is what's a big part of what people are seeing right now on the ground in Sudan is because of that, and it's because of the weapons that the UAE are bringing into Sudan through different methods. So we're trying to like hit their PR, their soft power, the stuff that like allows them to kind of like launder their image and able to like pretend like they have no parts in that, and just basically expose them and just have their like hit their pockets as much as we can, so they can, we're hoping they can back off a little bit off of Sudan. So yeah, so that's where we're at right now.
No, appreciate it. And I look forward to kind of talking to you about that, because there are a lot of elements of UAE soft power too that like we see all the time, all over the place. And I think it's great that you all are kind of shining a light on that and encouraging people to boycott. So let's kind of start though. I kind of want to talk about sort of the last 7 years as a starting point, right? Because, I mean, I know that we need to have some historical context for all of this, but you've written a piece, which is also in the show description, where you kind of lay out some of that history. You've also had a conversation with Adnan where you went over like a lot of that history. And so I encourage people to check those out. I'll add Adnan's link to the show description as well. And we can get into some of that. But I think, you know, like there was a lot of hope around, you know, around Sudan, like in the last 7 to 5 years ago, right? I remember we had a conversation with Bador Allegra, who's, you know, also from Sudan, and like really feeling like, you know, there's this revolutionary kind of upsurge. There's all this great stuff happening at the grassroots. People probably are familiar with kind of the resistance committees and like some of this stuff from several years ago. And there's the ousting of Bashir, right? And then, you know, you just end up now we're in a situation, right, where, you know, people are talking about genocide or talking about like these horrific kind of war crimes that are going on there. They're talking about, you know, obviously humanitarian situation, which needs support. And, but because we don't get a lot of news and analysis in the West of what's going on in Sudan, I think it's difficult for people to understand, like, what happened, you know, how did we get from point A to point B? And maybe some people don't even know because there's so little coverage, right, about kind of how bad things are right now or how hopeful things were a few years ago. But I thought if we could talk a little bit about that recent history and kind of your analysis of like how that went and why it went the way it went, I think that would be a great place to kind of start the conversation and ground us.
Yeah, so what happened was there was, I mean, the Sudanese Revolution, 2019, that kind of time. And the main focus was taking down the Omar al-Bashir and his the Omar al-Bashir military apparatus, basically, that controlled Sudan, right? There was like a group of Sudanese bourgeois. They ran the entire country. They were focused on Khartoum. If you weren't part of the Khartoum elite, like you weren't going to succeed in any way. There was no opportunity for you. And I mean, the phrases that were used during the revolution were more about bread and the lack of bread, but that was just kind of like a means to an end. Like, it was just like, okay, now we can't even get bread. But really, it was about the whole thing. I mean, it was just frustration with the whole system. It reached like a breaking point. And then the people revolted, right? And even the two parties that we see today that are involved, they were involved from the very beginning. They were the ones used against the revolutionaries back then. The SAF and the RSF were both used to shoot at protesters and, you know, fight them not punish them for revolting. Basically, finally, Omar al-Bashir falls. I mean, through the people created their own bottom up, like the community kitchens, the resistance community, all the different kinds of apparatus, like institutions that they created for themselves that didn't need the state, didn't need anybody from the outside to help them out. And they ended up dropping Omar al-Bashir. But at the same time, it was, in a way, it was kind of like the people, the SAF and the RSF and the people, the foreign powers that have all their investments into Sudan, realized that there was no saving Omar al-Bashir's regime. Like, it was over. So sometimes what they do, like we've seen this in Egypt during the Arab Spring. We've seen this in different places where they allow the dictator to fall. The dictator comes down, you know, everything seems like it's getting better. We go into the democracy, like where we're going to civilian rule. And then, boom, it just kind of like flips. One day it just goes back into like a military coup. And then, like, we saw this in Egypt as well, right? We had the fall of Hosni Mubarak. We had Mohamed Morsi. We had the whole democracy. It felt really hopeful. And then coup, and then military dictatorship again. And then we're just back to where we started, or even worse. Sudan is kind of like in the same thing, except the people really did take down Omar al-Bashir. They did, like, it ended up happening. But some of the people that were still part of that Omar al-Bashir military apparatus kind of switched sides when they saw that there was no saving him, and they became part of the new government. They were like, okay, we're gonna transition from military rule to civilian rule. But, you know, you can't just do that transition all at once. So we're going to have, like, the military representatives and the civilian representatives, and they're all going to be in one transitionary government. And then eventually we're going to get to fully civilian rule. Obviously, that never happened. But what really, the part that people really don't know about is that in 2021, Burhan, who's the leader of the SAF today, and Hemeti, who's the leader of the RSF today, they colluded to overthrow the civilian government. And they did that in 2021. And that kind of led us to where we are today. Like, they overthrew the civilian government. They took power. They said, oh, we're just carrying out the will of the people or whatever. I mean, people were not happy with the civilian ruler, who's Hamdouk, who's, that's a long story, but they weren't happy with him. But at the same time, they used that as an opportunity to just kind of like take like control of Sudan again. And they were supposed to come up with like a power sharing agreement between the SAF and the RSF. And the SAF wanted the RSF to come under the army, and the RSF didn't want to do that. The whole thing is that this was all a plan from the beginning. Like, the RSF was already colluding with the UAE. from by this point, by 2021, by 2022, by 2023, like they were planning this. There was no real disagreement about power sharing or whatever. They just wanted some kind of excuse to overthrow the SAF and take over Sudan as a whole. So this was really, I mean, there was hope, there was revolution, right? It was getting to a point where there was real hope for Sudan. And then the counter-revolutionary forces in the region just didn't allow it to happen. Like, they had their own plans. They said, we can't allow a country like Sudan to take control of their own country, right? That messes up the whole imperialist thing that they have going on in Africa, in the Middle East, in the region, in the Red Sea. I mean, they can't have a revolutionary country on the Red Sea right there with control to all those resources, all that gold, all that oil, all the huge land, the strategic depth into East Africa and into North Africa and even into the Middle East. So they colluded with the RSF, which in between the al-Bashir falling and getting to the war breaking out in April 2023, they were actually the RSF was sent into Yemen to help the UAE and the Saudi coalition against the Houthis, against Ansarullah, right? This is where the UAE was familiar with the RSF and how they handled themselves as a mercenary group. Then they also used them in Libya to help out Haftar, the LNA, the ones in control of East Libya today, which is also a UAE proxy. And then they were like, okay, cool. So these are really good mercenaries that we can use to carry out our plan in Sudan. And one of the biggest things that people don't even know about is that the UAE offered the new Sudanese government money to buy up like all the fertile farmland that they had. They wanted, because the UAE is a desert, you know, it's a desert in the back of Amman. It doesn't really have any food source. Like, it has a lot of money, but with the direction we're going right now with climate change and everything, money's not going to mean a lot in the next coming decades. Like, it's going to become like a fight for food eventually. So the UAE is planning ahead for this, and they're like, okay, let's buy this. The Sudanese government refused, and now they just try to take it by force, basically. They've taken the gold by force. They try to take the Al-Ghazira scheme by force, which is why in December of 2023, you saw there was, you might have saw on social media, like Wad Madani, which was the second biggest refugee city in Sudan, fell to the RSF. That was the UAE trying to take the fertile land for themselves through their proxy. But yeah, so I know I went in a whole lot of directions there, but that is what happened in the last 7 years. There was hope. The imperialists got involved. They sent in their goons, and that's how we are. That's how we're there today. Basically.
Yeah, so I wanted to pull up for folks. I'm going to try to make this a little bit bigger because you're talking about this, and I recognize like geography is not the strong suit of Americans. And I know we have people listening from all over, right? But I want people to definitely understand kind of what you're talking about as you're situating this. I think it's important to understand, where Sudan is geographically. So obviously we're in here, the northeast, corner of Africa, basically right below Egypt. As you say, there's this whole section that is right along the Red Sea, obviously, which is very, strategic for all the reasons we know. We see, the strength of Yemen's blockade. We also know, historically the Suez Canal, but the Red Sea is also, it's not a very large waterway, right? So having both access to a port there, but also just coastline there. And then, the Nile River there comes through, right? And then just connection to, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Chad, South Sudan, of course, Libya.
This is like a colonial wet dream to have Sudan. I mean, just look, it's Libya's right there, Egypt's right there, the Middle East is literally like across the sea, you have the Nile River, you have the Suez Canal, you have Chad, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Somalia is within reach, like all, like literally if you have Sudan, like, I mean, any revolutionary, any anti-imperialist movement that might want to rise up in this region is going to be choked out. Like, having Sudan is akin to controlling that entire region. Like, you don't even have to control every single place specifically, but you're able to use that as a launching point, which I'm sure that's part of the like, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just like the UAE is the Sudan isn't their end all be all. Like they have a plan that's been going along. They have parts of Somalia, like Puntland and Somaliland, that they already have like kind of like under their control in a way. Have the east side of Libya. They bought up so much of Egypt, like financially, so they basically like own a lot of Egypt as well. They had they're in they're filling the president of Ethiopia's pockets. Like they have a plan for this whole region of Africa and the Sahel, and they want to have, I mean, just look at DP World, which is their port company. Like they have ports all around Africa. They've been setting up this kind of like corridor. This is what I call it, like a transnational corridor in this entire region. And it's for multiple reasons. And if they hold Sudan, that's kind of the key for the rest of the pieces will fall into place very, very easily.
Yeah, I was trying to also pull up, and I'm going to do it here in a second just for folks, a map that shows, let's see. This is not a great one, but at least it'll give folks the geography of the UAE in relation. Let's see how small that is. It's not too bad. Let's see. Right, so the UAE is actually like over here. It's if people, I don't know if people can see my cursor, but it's like north of Oman and Saudi Arabia. It's a small country here, and it's not close. I mean, it's close to some degree to Sudan, but it's definitely a different place there. And so maybe you could say a little bit just to help people understand of you talk about sub-imperialism and the UAE. And so what do you see as the UAE's kind of role as an actor regionally? And what kind of served, I know you see it serving a role for Western imperialism, but could you talk a little bit about what that looks like to you?
Yeah, so the UAE is like an interesting phenomenon because it's in a way we are already kind of familiar with the kind of state and entity that the UAE is in Israel, in the way that it's not a real country, it's not a real culture, it never existed before, right? They needed like a military base in the region to control the Middle East, and then they create this whole thing of Israel, right? And the UAE is kind of the same way. We had in Oman, there was a socialist revolution that was getting very successful, and the British were starting to get very afraid of that. So they basically they buy the loyalty of these seven states that were in Oman, who ended up creating the UAE. And one of the things that they did that for is for counter-revolution, against the Omani socialists. That was the first goal, which is just like cut them off from each other. And like we need somebody there who's gonna, whenever we need something, like they'll carry that out us for, like then they'll carry that out for us. I mean, we see this also in a way in Jordan, like Arab faces, but they carry out the will of the West, right? They'll even like risk their own lives, like knocking down those like Yemeni missiles or Iranian missiles to fall on their own land rather than risk hurting, Western goals. So we start with this Omani socialist thing. We start with them doing that, and then they eventually just take on this counter-revolutionary role, this sub-imperialist role, right? They're taking, I mean, Libya had their own revolution, right? I mean, there's an argument to be had about whether that was Western backed, the revolution, or what the goal wanted to have there. That's not what I want to discuss here, but they wanted to get things under control, basically. They couldn't have that just go to the people, right? So they have the UAE back this guy, which is Haftar, to take over all of Eastern Libya. I mean, I'm sure the goal is all of Libya, but right now that's what they have, right? And it's basically just like, in a way, the UAE to the West is kind of like what the RSF used to be to the Sudanese government. It was just, we want to do this thing, but we don't want to dirty our hands and our image. So we're just going to send you guys to do it for us. But I think in this situation, I don't even think they have to tell the UAE to do anything anymore. I think the UAE knows what their role is, and they take it upon themselves to just start doing things, like what's going on in Sudan. Like, they saw there's a revolution. A revolution in Sudan, a successful revolution, where the people, the working class, which is exactly what that revolution was. It was the working class. Like, the bourgeois was not involved at all. It was not a color revolution. It was the Sudanese working class. And they could have succeeded. And it's, I don't even like to say that the revolution died or ended, because right now, what we're seeing right now is the revolution versus the counter-revolution. That's what's playing out. It's the Emiratis versus the Sudanese people. It's the foreign powers versus the Sudanese people. So their role is stop any revolution, stop any successful revolution, make sure that it fails, make sure that the people regret ever standing up against the Western-backed puppets or against any Western interest, and make sure they never want to rise up in there ever again. And also teach their neighboring countries a lesson. Like, all the people who are watching Sudan right now, like, wow, look what happens when you try to stand up to do a revolution. Look, you get genocided, you get massacred, right? Let's, even if we were considering something, we're not gonna do anything. So, but if Sudan was successful, that would be very bad. It would create it for them, not for us. That would create a chain reaction where a lot of different countries might rise up, and that would quickly go out of control for the West and even for the sub-imperialist nations, who basically they get the, like, as long as they clean up the messes that the West creates with everything that they do, they get to keep all the change, all the gold and all the stuff that they exploit and everything like that. So it's also making them very, very wealthy and helping them maintain their lifestyle. So that's the role they do. They use their money, they use their soft power, they use their influence, they use their real power, they use anything that they have. They can buy up, like right now, they basically bought the African Union's silence. Like, every time they have an observer role in the African Union, every time Sudan tries to push for anything, they're not allowed to. Like, because the UAE has, they sent Hemeti, who's the leader of the RSF, to meet up with so many of the African leaders, and I'm sure that they've bribed them. They've bribed William Ruto, the president of Kenya, who has a whole lot of issues with him. But yeah, like, see, they work with all the puppets to basically just maintain that imperialist world order. That's their role. It's maintenance and it's cleanup, just to keep it simple.
No, appreciated. There's some good questions in the chat. I'll get to in a second. Other like I know we touched a little bit on the geography aspect. Are there other aspects of kind of the history of Sudan? You know, obviously we've mainly been talking about the last, 10 years roughly or so, that you think are like kind of really important to understand, this current war or like the resources or anything like that that you just kind of want to highlight as well.
From Sudan, you mean, right? Like, from
Yeah.
the,
Yeah.
yeah, so, and this is also kind of to answer one of the questions in the chat as well, in a way, right? So the Omar al-Bashir dictatorship had basically the Sudanese armed forces was the bourgeois and also the people in charge, right? So it's a military dictatorship we've seen in a lot of different countries in the global south. These people would use any method to keep control over they so when the British, the Anglo-Egyptian control of Sudan was in place, they made Sudan into a factory of exploitation and of like exporting resources, basically. So when and all the different dictators that came after, including the Omar al-Bashir and Sudanese armed forces dictatorship, these people just maintained the factory of exploitation. They maintained it in any way possible because it also filled their pockets. They were allowed to do any corruption they wanted to as long as those resources went from point A to point B, which is from the global south to Western pockets, to corporations, to billionaires, to wherever it needed to go. So there were people that caused them trouble in this factory. There were people that had to cooperate, and sometimes they wouldn't. some of these were South Sudanese people, right? There was a lot of oil in South Sudan, and this was very, very important to maintain this. But the South Sudanese people were not happy about the way the North treated them. After independence, the North cast them aside. They didn't allow them. I mean, for context, most of the time, South Sudanese people are darker than North Sudanese people. They're a lot of them are not. Most of them are well, actually no. All of South Sudanese people, if I'm not mistaken, are not Arabized. They don't speak Arabic. So this caused a lot of like they didn't want this. North Sudanese did not want them in the government. They did not want them to have any real power, but they still wanted to control them and have power over them. This created a very long struggle in the Sudanese civil war. Two of them actually, which was basically South Sudan wanting to take their own independence. So this was a big part that. So if you see that this, it's a ethnic group or ethnic minority group in Sudan who is coming in the way of the extraction that the Sudanese bourgeois was trying to keep continue carrying out, and they needed any method to crush those revolts, right? So we see this already with South Sudan. Now this happened again. This happened in the Nuba Mountains, right? We have the SPLMN, which is the northern version of the SPLM, which is the South Sudanese like revolutionary organization, right? They're situated in the Nuba Mountains. The Nuba Mountains also ho host a ethnic minority groups that are in Sudan, and the SAF has brutalized them over the years. And then we have one of the more relevant to today's thing and the creation of this entire monster as we know it, the RSF, which is Darfur. Darfur is rich in gold. Darfur is rich in oil. Darfur is rich in I'm pretty sure even diamonds, and just a whole lot of resources are in Darfur. But the Darfurian people are, many of them are not Arab, Arabized. Like they're not Arabized Africans. A lot of them are ethnic groups, Fur or Zaghawa or different people who do not speak Arabic. And there were these Arabized nomadic tribes, nomadic groups, not just from Sudan, also from Chad, also from those areas. They had previously gotten some money from Gaddafi in the past in his pan-Arabist days, but they would basically just cause trouble for the different ethnic groups. Like they didn't really have any land of their own or anything of their own, so they would just come and steal cattle. They'd come and steal like whatever they can, but they knew the area really well. Their ancestors have been there for a very long time. So when the SAF wanted to crush the Darfurian revolts of the early 2000s, they didn't send SAF soldiers since they were already involved in so many war crime investigation and ICC, ICJ, all this kind of stuff. They didn't want to continue that bad PR that they were having. So they paid these people, these tribes, these nomadic Arabized people, to basically deal with the problem for them. And those people committed genocide. And at the time, those people were called the Janjaweed. So all of this was about resources. All of this was about maintaining the factory of exploitation, right? And they outsourced the violence to the Janjaweed, which means in Sudanese dialect, devil on horseback. And for one of the questions in the comments, no, I'm not Sudanese. I'm actually from North Africa, but I've been following this for a very long time. But yes, to continue. So those people did a, I guess you could say, a good job at genocide and at massacring and at taking out like ethnic minorities and stuff. And they didn't just kill the people who were revolting. They like came down with the iron fist. They wiped out like villages, right? So this put them in good standing with Omar al-Bashir at the time. And Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo was the leader of them. So he, which is Hemeti, the one we know as Hemeti today, right? Hemeti, he, as a gift, he gets a gold mine from Omar al-Bashir, which he has been passing off the gold from that to the UAE as well to this day. But they were brought into Khartoum and they were allowed to create this official militia called the Rapid Support Forces, by 2013. They were sent on different mercenary missions by Omar al-Bashir all around Sudan, and then outside of Sudan. They went to Libya, they went to Yemen, they went to different places. They worked for different countries as well. They even worked for the EU to do border control for Europe. Like if they caught migrants coming up from the part that's beyond Sudan, they would stop them, basically. And they were receiving money and funding from the European Union for this. So that group becomes the RSF, which becomes the RSF that we know today. But at one point, the RSF was still basically Sudanese, except for the leader. He's actually from Chad. He's not even from Sudan. But that group, now isn't even Sudanese anymore. They're whoever the UAE can find. They hire anybody. They've hired Colombians. They've hired Ethiopians, people from Chad, people from South Sudan, people from different areas. It's just whoever needs money, whoever's willing to commit the atrocity. But yeah, so all of these different things, it's ethnic minorities who want their rights, want their freedom, want their liberation, coming in the way of the extraction process that the Sudanese bourgeois needed to do on behalf of the West. And this ended up creating multiple issues, including the RSF that we know today. So I hope that all came together the way I wanted it to.
I appreciate it. Let's talk about the UAE a little bit more. So, you know, one of the things that I think about when I think about the UAE is, I think we're going to have a conversation a little bit more on sports washing with Alex Avinia this month too. But there's three Emirates Cups. There's one going on right now. If you're a basketball fan, there's the NBA Emirates Cup, and then, there's multiple ones in, football or soccer. And then there's also the branding around Dubai, right? One is as you referenced it, as, them being created, in part to, as counter-revolutionary against, Oman. The thing that I was thinking about actually is in Matteo Capazzo's book behind me about Libya. He talks about how Dubai was held up as the alternative to them, right? Stop being, anti-imperialist and difficult, right? Be like Dubai, right? And we hear this kind of language also related to Gaza as well right now. You don't have to be this, the harboring terrorists, obviously I'm saying this very sarcastically, but that's what the West would say, right? You can be, a capitalist port city like Dubai, right? And so it's held up regionally as this kind of thing that is held as an aspiration for basically Western imperialism to say to states that are resistant to Western imperialism of, look how poor your anti-imperialism makes you, right? No discussion of sanctions, right? Or military bases or all of the things done to destabilize countries that try to choose a different path of development. But, look at the alternative. You could be like Dubai, right? And then obviously recently, especially within the last year, and I don't even know if this actually has connections to actual Dubai, but Dubai chocolate is everywhere in the West. It's become this big thing. They sell it at malls and in all these different stores and so on. And so it's just an interesting thing where it's obviously it's a very small country. It's a country that I think most people in the West don't really know much of anything about. But they know it through these kind of branding or marketing exercises, right? And obviously, they may have known about it also as a tourist destination or something like that too. So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of these elements of UAE's soft power and how it kind of brands itself and the different ways. It's also an interesting place because at one point oil was very significant to its economy, but it's really not anymore. It's 1% of their GDP right now, and they've really diversified into other areas you know, sports and tourism and other things like that as well. So yeah, anything that you would want to say about all of that?
Yeah, so starting with the Dubai chocolate thing, only because, okay, so I've been saying on different social media sites that I do not think that that's a coincidence. It does have something to do with Dubai, and it is like it that started around the same time that we got we spoke to Macklemore's team as the boycott that we're running, and we got him to cancel his show. And a lot of the headlines at the time about Dubai were Macklemore cancels Dubai show over involvement in Sudan. And then the same thing with SZA, same thing happened, right? And around that time, more headlines started coming out and more stuff in the media started coming out about Dubai specifically and their involvement in Sudan. So it just kind of felt like they were just countering that with some kind of, you know, craze. I mean, these influencers are bought like very easily. Like that's kind of how it took flight. And then as soon as something catches on and influencers make it a thing, then people want to buy it. As soon as people want to buy it, then obviously capitalists will serve that market. They'll put it. And you're right. Like I go to 7-Eleven or I'll go to anywhere. And it's like always, there's always a Dubai chocolate right there. So I do not think that's a coincidence. I do think that was kind of like a laundering method, kind of like a drowning the news method, like something to just make the conversation about something else very quickly. And Dubai was already, and the UAE as a whole was already kind of starting to be mentioned in like the early 2000s, 2010s about their involvement in different crimes, different human rights violations in their own nation and also abroad. And I do think that this played a huge part into them starting to invest a lot into, like, for example, right, some of the most popular teams that you might see in, like, the Premier League in the UK will always have the Emirates Airways or Etihad sponsorship, right? And this kind of, like, causes, like, a rewiring for people. Like, you're seeing this thing all the time associated with the thing you like. Like, it's not going to make you look at this in a negative way. And on the other hand, also, you see they most definitely were paying, I mean, people like Future, people like different rappers, different R&B artists, different celebrities from all the different, like, walks of life were coming to the UAE, coming to Dubai, posting about it on Instagram, wearing the thobe, the long white thing and the red, you know, cover on their head and doing that whole thing. Like, ah, come to Dubai, guys. Look how fun it is. Look how whatever it is. Like, it's for moments like these. Like, they do this for moments like these, right? Because all people associated with Dubai before this point was all like, oh, it's like this, like, fun place you can go to. It's like New York City on steroids. It's so cool. Burj Khalifa, and it has all this pretty stuff. And you can, my favorite celebrity went there. And also, they have sponsorship with my favorite soccer team. And the NBA has cups sponsored by the UAE, right? Like, this is, when you say things like, oh, the UAE is involved in this or is involved in that, people have a knee-jerk reaction to kind of be like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. Or like, no, like I'm not going to stop going. Like, I've had people tell me this. I'm not going to stop going to Dubai just because of something that you're saying. Like, it's probably not even true, right? Like, it kind of, they pay a lot of money to be involved in whatever kind of, like, they host art galleries, right? Like, international art galleries, they host them there, right? They host music festivals, they host celebrities, they host soccer players, they host basketball players, they host football, like NFL football players and football players, obviously, in the soccer way, right? Like, it's like whatever possible PR thing that they can do, they've done it, right? And they have a lot of money, so it's really not that difficult to do that. So that's, yeah.
I just want to ask you about also, like, the, like, there's, like, I don't know the exact term, is kafala system? Like, so there's, like nearly slavery, right, in the UAE also on, like, a very large scale. Could you talk a little bit about that system and help people understand, like, that exploitation as well? Because obviously this is also where a lot of the wealth comes from.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you see these big buildings and the glimmering lights and everything, that's all built by either South Asian or African people that they bring over. And the way they do it is they will offer you in your home country. They will hit you up on some WhatsApp or a social media site or something like that and offer you a great job in your field, right? Offer you a lot of money. As soon as you come over there, whoever brings you over there, they basically sponsor you for like a visa, right? And they have like a specific visa just for this system. They take away your passport. You're not allowed to go back to your home country. And then they pay you scraps and then you just have to work there. And this, so many people like say that, oh, my cousin, my uncle, my whatever went to the UAE and we haven't heard from him since. And this happens quite a lot. And they'll pay you scraps. They'll pay you a tiny bit. So they'll be like, well, technically, it's not slavery. But they'll take away your passport. You're not allowed to go back home. Many times people die in from heat exhaustion, from that kind of thing. I mean, the Burj Khalifa, that was all them. That was all. Even during COVID, they've had some of these people that's under the kafala system dress up as hand sanitizers and have the Emiratis pump sanitizer from a person. There's a person with that's a hand sanitizer. That's the kind of dehumanization that they put people through. But yeah, it's basically that. They'll trick you into coming into the UAE. Then the person who brings you there will take away your passport, take away your identification, take away any type of legitimate way that you have to go back home. And then you're just stuck there. And then you have to work for them. And usually it's for a certain number of years or something like that. But some people like maids and whatnot. And maids is a very nice word to say. Honestly, it's slaves. The slaves that they have in their houses, the ones that are cleaning their homes and taking care of their kids and whatever, are stuck there sometimes for life. They're never allowed to go back. And they go through a lot of abuse as well at the hands of the people who are bringing them there. So, yeah, it is slavery, pretty much.
Yeah, and I was going into this the other day, and I can't quite find it, but the Emirates airline, also, for people should know, it's owned by what's called the Emirates Group, which is basically it's owned by the ruling class of, so it's essentially state, but it's an even smaller set of actors, right, than probably the entire state. And so when you, and it's one of the largest in the world, it's worth $60 billion. It's huge. So, yeah. I don't know if you had anything else, but so let's talk a little bit about the boycott then. When you look, cause I know that boycotting UAE is one of the things that you have pushed, how what targets do you have? Do you have a website for this? And how do people know what to boycott to ensure that they're not supporting the UAE?
Yeah. So, we have an Instagram that's, at Defund the UAE. There's a couple of different, targets. There is, give me 1 second. I'm just going to pull up a link real quick. So there's the boycott the UAE. There's a website. I'm trying to remember the exact URL, what it was, but that has a lot of targets as well. Our main targets are tourism, going to the UAE itself. We're also targeting Uber and Shell, who have huge connections to. They make huge profits off of the UAE. They have huge investments there, and they profit a lot off of whatever money that the UAE is making off of this. There's also a couple of gold companies and jewelry companies that we have listed. We have an infographic.
If there's a private chat, so if it's a link, you can drop it in there, and I can pull it up.
Yeah. So. Got it. Boycott.org. I also know that now the Boycott, I don't know if you like the Boycott app, has also added our targets into their app as well. So if you already have that, there's a Sudan section now. So I'm sure that can help as well. But yeah.
Another thing I would say too for folks is that the UAE also definitely played a role in the destabilization of Syria too. Like they switched sides at different points, but they ultimately were definitely like a net, on the side of the West and basically overthrowing the Syrian government. So yeah, that's another example of what they do. But so this is the website here.
Yes.
Ah, cool. All right. So yeah, this is just boycottuae.org. I will put that in the chat as well. Also, folks, if there's other questions that you have, I can, we can share them with Hamza. Let's talk a little bit more about the mutual aid work and so on. So, how do you see this? Like, I know there's different views around, so-called charity or like, obviously you're very engaged in, not just work related to the Sudan, but also to Gaza, which is how, like, I think you and I first got connected. So what is your kind of analysis on, the utility or the purpose of these efforts to, get resources to people in these places?
I mean, the way I always frame it for people, because it seems like people kind of sideline those efforts. It doesn't feel as glamorous as posting red triangle videos, and cool like edits of which I also make. I also enjoy edits of Qassam frying whoever they're frying, but at the same time, it might not feel as glamorous, but it really is one of the most important things. Like if people in Gaza and people in Sudan, like people in Al-Fashir, for example, are specifically being starved by the imperialists, by the enemy that we are fighting, that's a war on of starvation. Like they're waging a war of starvation, which means one of the fronts of their war, is food. That's something very important, is resources, is keeping people alive. So it's not just like the utility is not only keeping people alive, but you're literally fighting back against them. You're fighting that front of the war. Like if for example, if we see ourselves as allies in solidarity with the people on the ground who are fighting the main war, right, in every way possible, fighting the genocide, fighting to stay alive, then us keeping people alive, us finding ways to combat the war of starvation that they are waging, is really us fighting this front of the war. Like we are helping, like they want people to starve to death. They want people to give up. They want people to feel the pressure and either leave their homes or surrender, allow, like if they're under siege and they're not getting any food, they wanted people to leave Gaza, for example, right? They wanted people to leave Al-Fashir, or they wanted people to surrender Al-Fashir. In both cases, this was the case, right? But if you're keeping people alive and you're helping people stay alive, right? Something that the resistance, for example, couldn't focus on at the time. They're busy fighting the military battle, right? So the least we can do is at least keep their family and their friends and their neighbors and the people above them alive. It's very important. It's combating the war of starvation, like I said before. And I really like the utility is not only just, oh, we're helping people. It's charity, like the way NGOs do it. Like, it feels good to help people, but it's literally an anti-imperialist struggle that you're doing by keeping the targets of imperialism alive, by helping them survive another week and another month and another year, when all the efforts are by the imperialists to stop that, to get them to collapse, basically. So that's my take on that.
No, I think that's great. Good question. What's up, Don? So the question is, what media outlets would the hosts recommend to keep up to date with the Sudanese genocide? And are there any books that you recommend to learn more about the history of this crisis? I mean, one, just to shout out so that Hamza doesn't have to shout out, is the Telegram channel, which is in the show description that Hamza and others run to kind of keep people up to date on news updates. But are there other places that you look or you think do a really good job covering this? Because I know that, you know, it's a spot I mentioned at the beginning that we haven't covered a whole lot. And I also know that's the case for a lot of other news outlets, even ones that are anti-imperialist in the core, is that it's just not getting a lot of coverage. And there's not a lot of good analysis that, you know, people unfortunately are getting as a result of that. So what are some of the places that you look to or you suggest?
Yeah, so unfortunately, media outlets are not really doing much, but there is like individuals and like groups who are doing. there's a very good account on Twitter. I don't know if you guys have Twitter. It's literally called, wait, I could type it in the private chat, but it's BS on Blast. She does very, very good work. She like covers a lot of what's going on the ground consistently. So that's the account right there. Her name's Sarah. She's Sudanese and she covers a lot of that. A lot of the stuff is basically on Twitter. There isn't really, I don't really have a website or something where people, because, you know, the media really isn't covering it the way they should. Or if they do, it's like once every like 3 weeks, they might cover one event out of the dozens of events that are happening in between when they release like news. There's also, but this is in Arabic, and that's why I recommend that people go on the Telegram, because I translate Sudan war.
This is the person you were saying.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. She covers a lot, and then also at the end of every day, she has like, if you scroll down, I'm sure it's on her pin. She has a yeah. See, today's quick update. So usually she has like an update for the day. You can open it, and then there's like a thread of different events that's happened throughout the day, and she also shares some of the best analysis and stuff like that from even different accounts. So you might even find on there different accounts that you can follow that are also consistent, you know, from Sudan.
Yeah, sorry. I think Sudan War is another one. All right, I'll pull that one up too.
Yeah, but this one is in Arabic. That's the only thing. I mean, you could use the translate feature if you want. If you don't, I also, this is one of my sources that I use to post on the Telegram. So if that works for people, they can also just go in the Telegram and just catch that in English. Yeah.
Got it. All right, let's see. Is there anything else from the chat? Appreciate you, Hamza, for this. This is great to like connect with some different folks. Somebody also raised up some good campaigns to donate to Sudan and Congo, the Doctors Against Genocide, and solar panels to hospitals, etc. Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, the only other question I had to you is, you know, what are, in your estimation, some of the reasons for this kind of lack or gap? You know, I mean, I realize that involves you to get into like people's psychology and other things like that. I mean, often when I hear Sudan, right, like it is in relation to people talking about Gaza, right, or talking about Palestine and saying, hey, like we need to pay attention to what's going on in Sudan and what's going on in the Congo as well, which I agree with, right? And I think most people do. But I think the question that we raise, like already you can kind of see in this discussion that, you know, there aren't a lot of sources in English. And I think that's, I mean, one is we have to get better at even using tools, like you said, of even just, you know, as limited as online translation may be and the problems that exist with it, like making that effort to translate stuff that's in other languages, I think is something that we should be doing if we don't speak those other languages, right? To just broaden the analysis that we get, because within the Anglophone sphere, there is just going to be some limitations. And, you know, Black Alliance for Peace also shout them out. I know that they do work to keep up and to do provide analysis of what's going on in Sudan as well. We did talk about that a little bit in our AFRICOM discussion last month. And what is your thoughts on that? Like, is it just that there's not been, like, one of the things with Gaza that we can say, right, is that there's been a clear effort by Palestinians over the last, 30, 40 years, right, to get their analysis out, not just in Arabic, but also in English, right, which required them also to then, people like Rifat Alarir, and others, right, of saying like, okay, I'm going to actually teach English specifically for the purposes of people being able to provide analysis to the Anglophone world, even though it's not the primary language here, right? And I think obviously we can see the fruits of those kind of efforts in terms of that. I mean, it shouldn't obviously be on the colonized people, on the people who are under war and oppression, to have to learn another language to teach it to share what's going on with people in other parts of the world. Like, but obviously we can see, I guess the benefit to some extent. I mean, obviously what's happening in Gaza is absolutely horrible. So, there's also limitations of awareness raising even in general. But I don't know what your thoughts are on the kind of the gap or the difference between coverage between, one section or another, or why there's more information in certain areas versus other areas.
I mean, I'm gonna be completely honest. Number one thing, and this is something that I've observed personally, number one thing is just people like internalize anti-blackness and people just not caring as much about black people as they care about other people. This is just, I'm gonna just be very straight up. That's one of the biggest reasons I've seen, right? People see that. And they're just like, they just keep scrolling, right? And there has been an effort, and I'm talking about people on the ground in Sudan typing their stuff up in Arab, in English, I mean, and posting what's going on in English. Like, there were people who have been posting now for years in English, like, from not from just when this started, like from 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, right? Like, posting from Sudan in English, trying to raise awareness. But on the other end also is when things happen in Africa, I feel like the media, the way they framed it, people just kind of like, another civil war. It's one of those civil wars over there, in one of those places. Like, this is something that you always hear. They some people like genuinely have thought, like when you try to talk to them about Sudan, they're like, I thought this is always a civil war over there. Or I thought this is the same civil war that started like 30 years ago or something. Like, they never even thought that the civil war ended. They think this is just all one big civil war. They think that people over there are always fighting and it's too complicated and it's like some tribal stuff that they won't understand. There's also people who genuinely were giving us a lot of pushback because they were saying that we're just trying to distract from Palestine and we're Zionist Asians pushing Sudan to take away from the Palestinian cause or something like that. I've also run into that. That's hasn't been one of the bigger ones, but that is something that some people genuinely believe. They believe that the other causes were brought up only to bring away from Palestine. And while and I can see why people might think this, because when the Zionists are looking for something, they're like, why doesn't anyone talk about Yemen? Why doesn't anyone talk about Sudan? Why doesn't anyone? But they don't even talk about Sudan, right? Like, you're talking to Sudanese people, like, actually, who are actually just trying to advocate for their people. But yeah, it's the lack of media coverage. It's the lack of people willing, like, having the willingness to look into things, right? And also is just, I guess, like, the truth about Sudan isn't as mainstream, right? And I'm sure that the buildup of years and years and years, which has reached the breaking point of the Gaza genocide, is a part of, I mean, we've seen, like, every time something happens in Gaza, more and more people kind of, like, wake up to it. Right. And then I guess another factor of it would be as well, like, people in Sudan can't record what's happening the way people in Gaza can people in Sudan, I mean, we're talking more about a lot of times it's bombs or it's something from like the top, like, you know, from far away, or drone strikes and stuff like that. While, I mean, there are soldiers on the in the ground in Gaza, right? They're throughout the thing, but then in Sudan, it's always militiamen that are like in front of your face. Like, you can't really record their crimes. If you're that close, you will probably end up being killed too as well. So that's another thing. And they literally threaten people not to record the RSF. There's a lot of different factors. But now the RSF are like literally recording it themselves. So like, I feel like if people want to, like, they will. And it took Fashir falling and for all those atrocities for people to finally, like, you know, kind of like wake up a little bit and kind of pay more attention. So I'm hoping that this momentum can stay. But yeah, I really do think it's like the two main reasons to probably be anti-blackness and just ignorance, people just not knowing what the reality is.
No, I appreciate that. I think that you're right about that, and I appreciate folks in the chat also. I think it's important to consider what Africa and Africa represents for the average people on the level of their imagination. Not much progress has been made. Chidimacha also said Africa is just naturally a mess, in quotes. That's why people don't pay attention. No clue that it's a mess due to Western footprint on the continent. Yeah, and I mean, I think this connects to, I think Ali Kadri talks about it in the accumulation of wastes, but it's also something just in general of this idea that media implants in our minds, right, of countries that just can't get it together, right? Like this idea that, you know, it's a backwardsness thing, and that they can't figure out how to rule themselves, right? And so it's always becomes a problem. You know, and again, I completely disagree with this, right? But this is sort of the narrative, is that it becomes a problem of people's incapacities to self-rule and stuff like that. And obviously, you see the, you know, unfortunately, like that, the logical outcome of that line of thinking becomes the way that the West treats Haiti and treats, you know, Gaza now, right? Where you have basically, you know, the UN Security Council saying these countries cannot, you know, or these people cannot self-govern, right? And so we have to impose, you know, a colonial government of these kind of, you know, coalition of the willing, basically, to run their affairs for them until such a time that we determine that they're capable of doing it. And that has a long history, is actually a tactic of colonialism that doesn't call itself colonialism, although it's connected in with direct colonialism as well. Absolutely imperialist thinking for sure. And so yeah, I mean, I think that all those things are at play, as well as the anti-black racism, a kind of general anti-African viewpoint too. Obviously, knowing that not everybody is black in Africa in the way that, you know, people imagine, especially in North Africa. But, you know, this just general view, right, that we have in the West, that, you know, doesn't look at imperialism, it doesn't look at resource extraction and militarism and the types of development that have been allowed, right? Which is also important, is that the development that have been allowed in this country are to get in these countries have been to get the resources out of them, not to actually allow for people to, you know, have infrastructure that they need for themselves and for their societies. So, yeah, much appreciated. What does it say? Flip side of Phil, at most, Sudan or Haiti or Congo is just a rhetorical wedge for people. We say, why don't we care about it? Yeah, so I think this is a tricky thing. I think the what I would say to this is it can't just be that, right? Is that if it is just a rhetorical wedge, then it does become kind of what you're talking about, where, you know, it could be a tactic that anybody could use to say, oh, you shouldn't care about what you care about because you don't care about all these other things, right? The flip side of that is that, you know, I remember, I don't know if Kali Akuna, I think Kali Akuna said it when he was on here, actually. He was like, we can't be selective internationalists, right? We're either internationalists and we care about all of like every struggle around the world and understanding it, or we're being selective, right? And there is something to that. You know, if you're truly an internationalist, then, you know, Sudan should be important. Like you said, they had a revolution. There are a lot of people there that, you know, we should care about and who have politics also that are interesting and dynamic. And, you know, obviously on a human level, we should care about all of these places as well. But that means we have to actually do the work to do the education. And I think breaking out also of that, you know, monolingual English sphere is also a big issue. Maybe people dip a little bit into, you know, stuff in the Western Hemisphere, even if it's in Spanish, right, because of proximity. But struggles in other parts of the world is often a place where, you know, we fall short. So anyway, I appreciate you sharing resources and this discussion. Just looking to see if there's other comments that I missed. Good point on chocolate from Chidi Matcha too. It's one of those products that also always comes at the barrel of a gun. You know, it's native to Americas and grown in millions of acres of land in Ghana where people can't grow food or live on that land, right? The other thing I should say about this too, just for people to understand the scale of it, like if you just Google it, like 90% of the workers in the UAE are immigrants, right? And they all are kind of under that kafala system we were talking about earlier that is, you know, akin to, you know, modern day slavery, however people want to talk about it. But basically, all of the structures that you were talking about that, you know, make sure people are paid very paltry sums for long, hard labor and under, you know, forced labor and without their passport, so they don't have the ability to return, right? That's like the baseline. And, you know, that's most of the working class of those of that society. And of course, one of the things I think is important too is we would hear about all of these things, right? If it was that the UAE was actually, you know, antagonistic to the West in some way, right? But we don't, like, the United States doesn't care at all, right, about labor conditions in the UAE, because it's their buddy, right? And I think that's the same thing, like with, you know, I mean, Israel obviously being a stark example, right, of, you know, you of course you're going to overlook settler colonialism and overlook apartheid and even overlook genocide, right, because like it's your partner that's doing it. So
well, if it's China or Iran and I had 1% of the kafala system, we would never hear the end of it. There'd be 15 articles a day from Washington Post and the New York Times and the Huffington Post, and every single CNN would be covering it all the time. You know, they'd have Vice News would have an episode about it or something like that. Like, but you rarely hear about it. You used to hear about it back in, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe here and there. But other than that, they don't really like to cover the UAE or Saudi Arabia. They're two Gulf besties.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Don, so asked a question about like Twitter, was talk about the continued relevance of Twitter despite recent international relations. And then I asked for a little bit of more clarity and said, wanted a deeper dive into the relevance of social media over mainstream media outlets. Is social media a major outlet given the lack of coverage from network news? One thing that I would say related to that conversation, Don, is that we had a conversation, I guess it was earlier this week, and I'm blanking on the guest's name, so I'm apologies, but I'm going to look it up real quick. But it was about really connected a lot with social media and Palestine. It was about digital settler colonialism, Palestine in terms of servitude, you know, which is a book that was written by Omar Zaza. And so Omar was the guest for that conversation. And his book talks about this quite a bit, and it's very interesting. And I mean, like, one of the things that he wants to dispel is this idea that social media is different in like really meaningful ways from corporate media. Like it's another form of corporate media, but at the same time, obviously, and these websites are really working overdrive, I think, to make sure that we can't see a lot of the good reporting and stuff like that that goes on there more and more. But there are still people, right? There are tons and tons of people that are on these sites that, you know, are working to educate themselves and to study stuff and to share information, like Hamza here and the other folks that he's, you know, working with and following. And so I think that's the thing, is that, you know, for better or worse, it's here and it's something that we have. It's not necessarily a net positive on the whole, but if you know how to use it, then, you know, there are ways to find things and connect to things that you probably wouldn't be able to otherwise, right? And so I think certainly we have to have a larger critique of, on the whole, you know, most people are not using these apps to like really educate themselves about, you know, imperialism, anti-imperialism, radical politics. Like that's a niche, you know, within all of these spaces that is kind of always under attack to a certain degree. But those things do exist in these spaces as well, right? And so I think that's kind of the rub of it. But I think part of what, you know, our guest Omar talked about in that discussion is, you know, you can't rely also that that role will always be there. Like people will try to use it there, but these apps, like part of the reason that they're pushing so hard on the algorithms, or they want to show us cat videos all day, or, you know, whatever else, is because they recognize how much, for instance, specifically with regards to Palestine, that, you know, social media has become a space where people can get different analysis and news and actually break with the imperialist perspective on it. And so it is actually a threat. And it's a threat that both, you know, Twitter or Instagram or Meta, right, or all these companies are actually constantly trying to combat, right? Which is why they ban people. It's why they shadow ban people. It's why, you know, Palestinians have more and more trouble sharing their fundraisers, like all of that stuff, because they recognize that people are using these tools in ways that they actually don't want us to be using them. All right. Anything else you want to say in closing, Hamza? Any reminders or just other things you want to say, share, or plug?
I mean, you know, everything that we shared already and all the stuff that we plugged already, I hope people check them out and, you know, share them themselves and promote them as well. It'd be a great help to the work that we're trying to do. And if you're trying to follow along with the news in Sudan, the Telegram channel will be a great resource. I'm hoping that can help you guys out as well. And just wanted to second what you just said, because I'm on my, I think, 17th or 18th Twitter account since October 2023. So, yeah, for sure. I think they definitely don't want us to be talking about this kind of stuff. But, yeah, thank you for having me. And thank everybody in the audience for listening and following along. It's
right on. Yeah, I just wanted to lift this up to somebody shouted out Upscrolled. I'm not. Is this, maybe the second one is Red Book. I'm not as familiar with that one, but the but Upscrolled is a project which we did talk about in that conversation with Omar as well, of tech against apartheid, right? So it is actually, it's a very Instagram like app that's created specifically to avoid censorship of pro-Palestine stuff and anti-imperialist stuff. So people should definitely check that out. And yeah, man, appreciate the work you're doing. I encourage people to check all of the links in the show description to, you know, follow and support, and, you know, check out Sudan Funds, share it with folks. And yeah, we'll be continuing. I'm sure we'll do, you know, people ask for more conversations on Congo and on Sudan, and I'm sure that we will be doing more of that in the coming months, you know, get some different folks in with some different perspectives. And Appreciate you, Hansa. This was great. Thank you for joining me today.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Jared. Really appreciate it. Absolutely.